library since March of 1995. His interests range from biogeography to baseball, but none have consumed as much of his time as his research into Alfred Russel Wallace. His research on Wallace has led us to publications of numerous books, articles, and websites. Dr. Smith's search for Wallace has led him to study and lecture on three continents, and today he's going to tell us about some of his more recent research and lecture trips in Brazil and London. So if you will join me in welcoming Dr. Smith.
Well, actually, you underrated me because it's actually four continents, but that happened so long ago, I don't remember much of it anyway. So, anyway, thanks for coming. I understand we have some competition in terms of people's attentions today, but that's okay. We'll go for quality as opposed to quantity. I suppose I should first say a few words about Wallace himself, because not everyone... he's not a household name, although at one time he was a household name, and in fact may well have been the most famous scientist in the world at the end of his life. He was known as the, quote, grand old man of science, unquote, in his later years, and was very commonly asked for his opinion on all sorts of matters, ranging from seances to the latest findings in genetics, which usually he was not too warm on. Wallace himself was born in 1823. He died in 1913. So he was 90 years old when he died, just a month short of 91. And over that period of time, of course, the world saw a terrific amount of change. When he was a child, there were yet to be steam locomotives running the tracks. And by the time he died, there was we're on the verge of having commercial air traffic and automobile truck traffic as well. 1913. He came from rather humble beginnings. His father was a lawyer, or at least was trained for the law and was actually sworn in, but never practiced because he had a little bit of an inheritance. And for 15 years of his life. Led the sort of life of Riley, hobnobbing with people like Bulge Rummel and so forth. So despite the fact that some people have referred to Wallace's family as being lower middle class, he was really middle class, and it's just that his father didn't know how to make money. So they never had any money, and eventually, in fact, he was swindled out of his remaining inheritance, the elder Wallace. And Alfred was forced to quit school at age 13 and never returned. So from then on, he was self-educated. Became a surveyor's aide. He had an older brother who had a business in Western England and Wales. During a slow period, he taught, at the age of about 20 or so, 21, he taught at a private school in Leicester, England, which is a medium-sized city in the central portion of England, where he met another naturalist-to-be named Henry Walter Bates, who himself later became a prominent name in evolutionary biology. And the two of them eventually decided, after Wallace left again, to go back to surveying for a while. His brother had died, and he had to take over his business for a while. But they decided that they would turn professionals as natural history collectors, because both of them had been sort of collecting in an amateurish way for a number of years, although Bates had actually, even though he was younger than Wallace, had published a little bit. So in 1848, they went off to the Amazon, where Wallace stayed 4 years until his health deteriorated, and he tried to go home with the better part of his collections. And the ship he was on went out to the very middle of the Atlantic and then promptly caught fire and sank. Wallace himself and the crew were rescued after 10 days, but he had to spend 80 days on the ocean to get back to England. But that didn't stop him. It was 1852 by then, and after 15 months, he takes off for the Far East and spends the next 8 years in Indonesia, where, among other things, he co-introduces the theory of natural selection in a famous story where he sends the idea off to Darwin, who he had corresponded with a little bit. And Darwin freaked out, basically, decided to get on his horse and write an abbreviated version of the four-volume work he was planning, and that became On the Origin of Species. Wallace was still in the East. He returned 3 years later in 1862, by which point he was, of course, well-known to the at least natural history community, and then spends the next 50 years kind of hustling for work and writing and lecturing and doing all sorts of things that he had to do because of the fact that he was not really part of the elite power structure of the time. He was a spiritualist, he was a socialist, he basically didn't think twice about criticizing anyone he thought was trampling on the rights of the poor individual person. So all the upper crust people hated him because he was constantly sending letters to the editor and suggesting that the land be broken up and that socialism should be taken over and, dot, dot, dot. But all this activity was the reason why he became so well-known later in life. And when he died in 1913, he was not only if not the best-known scientist in the world, certainly one of the most, and one of the most known names in general. The obituaries that I have of him make it quite clear that he was a very well-known person in general. But the years haven't been so kind to him. The Darwinian horde has taken over and assigned sort of all of the glory to Darwin on the basis of On the Origin of Species. And not unfairly, but it's been a little bit too lopsided. And the reality is that Wallace's ideas are different enough from Darwin's to be interesting. And in some cases, the discussions that they had, where they were on one side or the other, are still being discussed. So on the matters that they did not agree on, it's gone pretty even as to who's won out over the years. Which also suggests that there's more reason to continue to take interest in him. So here he is at the age of about, 55, woodcut taken from a photo that appeared in 1878 or something like that. And so I just thought I would give you a little bit of history about him. In terms of these trips that I've been out of the country once in each of the last 4 years. The first one, I went to England, and we had a little get-together at that time, so I won't bother going through that again. But the last three trips, the first two were to Brazil, and the most recent, the longest one, was back to England. And they were for very different purposes. The two to Brazil were invitations that I got to speak at conferences. Two of them were conferences, and one of them was a colloquium. So I thought I would just show you some slides that involve where I've been over the last couple of years when I've been out of the country. I'm not a photographer anymore these days, but I, after combing the web for images, I was able to find bastante bien, as they say, number of images of places, and I would actually add all of these places. It's just that somebody else took the photos. And there are a few photos of me giving talks and things like that as well. But anyway, here's Alfred. So the first trip was to the south end of Brazil. And the south end of Brazil, the state of Brazil is Rio Grande do Sul, and it's just as far south as you can go in Brazil, across the border from Uruguay. And there is a capital city there, which is quite large, and in investigating at the time, I didn't realize just how big a city Porto Alegre was, but it's fourth largest city in Brazil, and this gives you some sort of an idea of just the general cityscape of the city. This was just a four-day trip, and I just pretty much went right through the airport and so forth, so I didn't get a chance to zoom around in Porto Alegre. But this is the wealthiest state in Brazil. It's very strongly German in background, so the Brazilians who were there look, on the whole, look like Americans. I remember a couple of times being in cafeterias and looking around and thinking, oh, geez, this could be Indiana. There's not as much of the Indian element in the population. Now, the actual talk that I was invited to give was in a satellite city called São Leopoldo, which is about a half an hour away. And this is a fairly good-sized city in its own right. It's about the size of Lexington. And it's one of about five or six such suburbs of Porto Alegre, which is a city the size of Boston or bigger. This kind of shot is not maybe quite so interesting as a street view. And this is more what it looks like at the level of the street. It's really quite charming. There's a lot of cobblestone streets and sort of close together streets and a lot of smaller shops with this kind of, I don't know what kind of architecture this is exactly, but it's kind of, to me, it looks sort of clean and quaint. I don't know how to put it exactly. And that's a very typical street scene in San Leopoldo, away from the banks and so forth. Restaurant areas and so forth. And now this is on the outskirts of Porto Alegre. This is the campus of the university that I gave the talk at. It's called Unicinos, which is an acronym for a god-awful long title, which I'm not sure I remember. But it's a good-sized university. It's one of the best private universities in the country. It's a Jesuit university. And right here is the main part of the campus. And notice this sort of round building. And I should warn you, a few of these shots are a bit blurry because they weren't really meant to be blown up to this extent, and this is one of them. But here's, the campus, and there's the round building. And this is quite a good-sized building. You could put a full baseball field inside there. Where I gave my talk was actually, if I remember correctly, in this building, overseeing this rather nice pond, which was filled with all sorts of some kinds of geese and ducks that I didn't recognize. That's always pleasant going somewhere and seeing birds that are different. When I was in Australia years ago, I remember the first time I ran to the kookaburra, which has a distinctive sound. I said, that's a kookaburra. And the guy with me was a botanist, but still knew, said, yes, it's a kookaburra. Okay, so next shot, we are inside that circle at night. Okay, so you're sort of in the middle of that big area inside the circle, and it's around you. And what's interesting about this is that this is rather late at night, but if it had been 7 or 8 o'clock when I was walking around a couple of times, many of these offices were actually open, and they had lots of students were in the building and doing things, and there were shoe stores and all sorts of commercial things going on. And what's interesting about that is, first of all, is that time of night, and the other thing is that there's no residential facilities on campus. All the students, all 20,000 of them, whatever, live in the city. So that means they had to have special means of getting in and out, and there are buses and so forth, of course. But anyway, kind of a neat structure. And here I am with Mr. Wallace again in the background, looming over as the giant of the history of biology, looming over everyone. They did have translation facilities, so everyone had the little thing in their ear, and there was an instantaneous translation going on while I gave the talk. It looks like I'm sort of leading a revival or something. that wasn't here. Here's the audience. As you can see, they look thrilled, and here's one guy looking the other way. And it turns out he's another one of the speakers, and he's in the next slide or the next slide afterward. Here's a sort of a PR collage, whatever that they put together, and I felt very satisfied with this because I had the largest hunk of it. And here we are after, I guess it was the day after the day I gave the talk, we're in the cafeteria, one of the cafeterias. And again, I looked around the cafeteria and I said, geez, this could easily be American students. But actually it couldn't though, because the buffet cafeteria was wonderful. The food was really good and so forth, so unlike most American university cafeterias. And this lady was the UNCINOS hosts international conferences. That's one of its main sort of things that it does, and every week it's doing another one. And she happened to be she's a philosopher of science, and she was the person who was in charge of this particular conference, which brought people from Europe and U.S. and other parts of Latin America, of course, in to give special talks.
Were they all Wallace people?
No, I gave the only Wallace talk. Okay. This was a Darwinism conference.
Gotcha.
And I was the token Wallace guy. But from any appearances, including that last thing, I was the featured person, which was kind of astounding, because there were some good people there. And here's another shot with me with my arms around another one of the organizers, and it seems like I granted all the small Latin Americans, because most of the guys I was with were little guys. But I just wanted to bring this up because of the wonderful mural, which is in the cafeteria, which is kind of a, we talked about it quite a bit while we were there, but this is only a portion of it naturally, but the figures, as you can see, are sort of impressionistic, or whatever the term is. And not at all your general Last Supper type of images. Well, a year later.
Oh, wow.
A year later, I get an invitation, partially on the basis of this first conference, to give another talk. And in Sao Paulo. And in telling a regular contact that I have in Rio de Janeiro that I was going to be coming down giving a talk, he said, "Well, why don't you swing over to Rio and give a talk?" And I said, "Sure." So they put me up on one of these hotels right here on the Copacabana Beach.
Wow.
Right in the middle of this. Copacabana Beach is about a mile and a half long. And here's a shot from the other direction.
Wow.
A sort of more colorful shot. And I don't remember which hotel I was in. It was just one of these. There's dozens and dozens of them. I don't even remember the name of it. But it was a nice hotel. The only trouble was is it was the middle of winter there. So, I couldn't expect to go out on the beach and see all these bikini-clad ladies. Or maybe not even bikinis. It was cold, and the only people that were out there were people playing volleyball and jogging or walking their dogs. So it was fairly light traffic. Here's another shot down by the, right near the beach, looking toward the hotels. And in the back is the famous Sugarloaf Mountain, which is about 1,300 feet tall. It's a granitic dome that comes right out of the sea, practically. I was only in Rio for about a little over a day and a half. So there was, and I had to give the talk during that time. They had translation there as well, even though it was just a colloquium talk. It was not even a long, planned thing, long in advance plan. And they asked me, what do I want to do? My host was accommodating, and I said, "Well, gee, I'd like to go up to the top of Sugarloaf Mountain." And it turns out that he told me along the way that actually Darwin, when he had been in this area and during his trip around the world, had climbed the mountain. And this was before, let's see, this is another shot of the beach at night, and then a shot probably from the top of one of the mountains of the whole area at night. And now we're down to the water level and looking at Sugarloaf Mountain, the smaller mountain. And if you look carefully, you can see some lines over here. And a cable device. So there's a cable. And it's really interesting because he drove me along and took me, and here I am in the middle of the city, right? And suddenly there's this place for taking this cable car up like 1,300 feet. And how many cities have that kind of physical environment? They don't. I mean, most cities are pretty flat. Well, there are a few, but this is the most famous one. Rio is separated by these mountains, and they have a lot of tunnels and that sort of thing. Well, anyway, when you're actually up there in the cable car, this is the sort of thing that you see. And I was there a little bit earlier in the day than this, but nevertheless, it had the same kind of setting, because while I was there, a little storm came through, and you know, with 50-mile-an-hour blowing winds, you had to make sure you didn't get blown off the mountain. So it was very much like this. Well, on to Sao Paulo. And I have a couple of slides in Sao Paulo. I was there about 2.5 days, and they wanted me to be close to the conference. The other one was the colloquium. It didn't matter as much, but they were paying my way and so forth. So again, I didn't really get to travel around Sao Paulo. But if you do, just be ready to take a really long time, because this is an enormous city, and this gives you some idea of it. And the next slide as well from the center, you just look.
What's the population, do you know?
It's one of the biggest cities in the world. It's well over 10 million.
Wow.
I don't know if it actually ranks first at this point, but it's near the top. It's the biggest city in the New World in population. Wow. And as compared to a couple in the Old World, I'm not sure. But well, I spoke at the University of Sao Paulo, which is Latin America's top university. Well, maybe not Latin America's, but South America's at least, for sure, top university. Although there wasn't really anything special about the performance or the buildings or anything, and I don't have any slides of that. Right around that time, I put in some money to try and travel to actually do some Wallace work as opposed to talk, and ended up going to England for 5 weeks, and that's what we have next. Now, I have a little map here which shows you the area that I was mostly in. This was supposed to be a work trip, and I've done some sightseeing in the past in London, so I didn't make that a high priority. But this is north is up, and this is the Kensington and South Kensington area of London. If you go up in this direction, about 3 or 4 miles, you get to the center of London. To the north is the famous Hyde Park, the western section of which is called Kensington Gardens. And south of that are a whole number of things. The Natural History Museum, where I was working mostly, is right here. This is Cromwell Road, which is the main thoroughfare, east-west primarily trending. And there's also the Victoria Albert Museum, this other blue area here. The University of London, the Imperial College, is right here. Royal Albert Hall is right there. The Royal Geographical Society is right there. And there's a bunch of embassies and hotels and just all sorts of stuff in that area. Whoops, went the wrong way. Here's another map, which is a little bit blown up, and it's a little bit to the west of the last map. So here's the Natural History Museum. I guess I don't need the pointer as much as I thought I was going to, David, but this works just fine. Here's the Natural History Museum. Here's Cromwell Road. And I was staying on a little side street over here called Emperor's Gate. And from about here to the middle of the Natural History Museum was about a third of a mile. So it was not a very long walk that I had every day. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you about the immediate area around where I was staying, because there are lots of photos available right on the web for a couple of reasons I'll mention. First, we'll start off with a little map. Here again is Cromwell Road going sort of east-west. And off this little side street, which is kind of V-shaped, is this Emperor's Gate. In the middle of the V, there's some apartments, and down the end, it's a cul-de-sac, basically, with a building at the end of it. Now, this is pretty prime real estate area. And in fact, the image that I have here is taken from a John Lennon site. That's where John Lennon lived during the height of his fame with the Beatles, number 13 Emperor's Gate. And I'm sure other people as well. I mentioned to a couple of you that a few weeks ago I saw the movie Darling, 1965 movie, English movie starring
Julie Christie.
Yeah, she won the Best Actress Award, and that made her career. And then she did Dr. Zhivago next. And during that movie, Darling, they photographed this building as the building where she is taking an apartment in London. So it's kind of represented. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to take a several shot tour down this street, because there's plenty of those available. Some of them are a little blurry. So we just turned the corner into the street from here. And this is right where John Lennon's address would have been. They tore the building down some years ago and put up some new buildings. But number 13 would have been right here. And then down at the end of the street, here's the Julie Christie building, as we'll call it, at the end of the street. It's about, you know, less than 1,000 feet long. So if we continue a little further, we're now a little closer to the end, and here's the second of the new buildings on the left. And in the middle, it's not really a park, there's a few trees in the middle there. Now this is one of the sections along the way. This is a remodeled structure which is now on the market. Anyone care to guess how much this four-story, five, one-bedroom building is being advertised for?
20 million?
Not quite that much. 12 million.
12 euros?
12 million dollars.
That many?
I've converted it.
One-bedroom?
One-bedrooms. Five one-bedroom apartments. $12 million. And I looked through some of the records of sales in this area for individual apartments over the last 10 or 15 years, and they range from anywhere from $200,000 to $1 million for an individual apartment. Well, condos, if you want to call them that. If you turned around and looked on the other side of the street through the trees, this was what was on the other side. Again, these are sort of typical townhouses. And here's that building, the Julie Christie building at the end of the street. And I was staying right over here on the next building, which unfortunately I only could find kind of a blurry slide for. Here's the Julie Christie, the JC building.
Yeah.
And this older, it's not older, but it just hasn't been remodeled. That's the reason why I was able to stay at, it was $82 a night, I think it was, which was quite cheap. Sort of scholar's residence type of thing, you know. Okay, we're continuing now back around. This is the end of the V, remember. Now we're going to continue back in the other direction. And when we're looking down the street, and then again in the middle, there are these trees. And if you just keep walking down this direction here, and you look across the street, here's the apartment complexes that fill the middle of the V, as it were. And if you keep walking out that way, you leave the area. Okay. And I thought I'd just show you a few shots of the general area. Now this is a shot along Cromwell Road in that same area. I think actually the museum is right over on the right hand side, but you can't see it. And another shot, this is one of the hotels along Cromwell Road in Kensington. And another sort of typical townhouses lining the street for endlessly. And of course you see plenty of these guys.
Yeah.
This should be larger than it is.
Oh, yeah, you can slide that one.
Yeah, well, it should be larger without the zoom, but well, anyway. Anyway, there's plenty of these guys floating around. When I was in England years ago, I used these guys every day because I was living in South London and had to get in the center. But this time around, I didn't. But there are, this is kind of an older model, but they have the sort of flashier square models that look brand new and so forth. But they're just basically all red double-decker buses, and anyway, slice it. This is a street scene on Knightsbridge Road, which is one of the streets that crosses Cromwell in that district. And it's just filled with little cafes and so forth. And over here is the tube station. If you look across the street, this is a typical patisserie, which I actually ate at several times because they had good fish and chips there, takeout fish and chips. And if you look back across the street, this is closer into the subway building, or the tube as they call it. And I had a little kitchenette in my hotel, so I did quite a bit of eating in-house. And there were a couple of really nice supermarkets within walking distance. And one of them was from the Waitrose, which is a chain. And it's like an arcade where you go in and you look up and it's all it's a glass and ceiling and so forth, and it has several shops, the largest one of which is the Waitrose supermarket. Now, if you go in the other direction up Knightsbridge Road, if you turn around, because we were starting to go south from Cromwell, if you go north, eventually you run into the park. It's about a 10-minute walk. And this is Kensington Gardens, and I have a couple of fast shots of that. Just general scenery. And then there's Kensington, the old Kensington Palace, which has its gardens, and another shot of Kensington Palace. In the Kensington Gardens, there's also the super, the super ornate Prince Albert Memorial, the husband of Queen Victoria, and I guess she must have really liked him because his statue is gold gilt covered, and it's extraordinarily ornate and beautiful.
Were you there in September, Charlie?
I was there in August and September, August. Yeah. There weren't quite as many flowers, but there still were quite a few.
Yeah, pretty sky.
And then right across the road is the Prince Albert Hall. Which is just convenient-sized and shaped to be able to get into one photo. So if you look on the web, you'll see about 600 of these shots just like this, sometimes from one side, sometimes from another. I didn't actually see any performances when I was there, but they were holding the, the proms. Every year there's a big series of classical concerts, that they were going on at the time, and they're held in Prince Albert Hall. This is the Royal Geographical Society, which is just a little bit down the street from there. They've built onto the front of it a new addition which goes below street level, where the rather sedate library is, and it has a small reading room where you ask people to get stuff for you, and you have the feeling when you're looking at it that they're looking at you, all the time. I didn't find anything really much of much use there, as it turned out. Here's another, just a couple of scenes in the general area of Kensington off of Cromwell Road. These are some side streets. So this gives you a general idea of what it looks like. I think I can remember exactly where this one went. And no, this is not the way it was supposed to be. I've gotten off of the automatic projector somehow. Here's another street. And now we have something special for you. I figured it was time, after drawing on, that you should have a short musical interlude. Well, we've now crossed the street to the south side of Cromwell Road, where is the majority of South Kensington is. Now, South Kensington is to London as Greenwich Village is to New York. And especially in the 60s, this was a very, this was where it was at, okay? With John Lennon living down the street and lots of other people, I thought I would find a song that I've known for a long time, Most of you probably do not know this song, but it's the flip side of the 45 single Mellow Yellow by Donovan, which most of you probably do remember because it's so weird. Well, this song is an interesting song. The name of the song is Sunny South Kensington, and it's talking about this South Kensington scene. I won't play the whole thing, but I'll play enough of it. There are a couple of interesting things about it. The bass lead-in is by the famous stand-up bass player Jenny Thompson, for those people who are music aficionados. This may be the only song that I can think of that features organ, harpsichord, and piano. Not all at the same time, thankfully, but anyway, here we go. This is Donovan's Sunny South Kensington. And listen to the lyrics, because he mentions people and stuff at the time, places and people. Here comes the harpsichord.
Come take a walk in sunny South Kensington any day of the week. See the girl with the silk Chinese blouse on, you know she ain't no freak. Come blue soon down Cromwell Road, man, you got to spread your wings. Flip out, skip out, trip out, and make your stand, folks, to take me as I sing. Jean-Paul Belmondo and Mary Quant got stoned to say the least. Ginsburg, he ended up a dry and
Alan Ginsburg got
it. I took a trip on tease. If I'm late waiting down the gate, it's such a rough scene. I grew the place to live. In a post belly, I
messed up
with a cane umbrella. Who must have used a sieve? So come loon soon down Cromwell Road, man, you got to spread your wings. Flip out, skim out, trip out, and to make your stand, folks, to take me as I sing.
This may be where the tune from Pretty Flamingo comes from. A hit from back then. Now we have a little rip-off of Oh Pretty Woman. Now the piano. Well, anyway. So that's about two-thirds of Sunny South Kensington by Donovan, and it gives you kind of the feeling for what was happening in that district in the old days. All right, let's get back to, Kensington Garden, South Kensington. Okay, well, I did have to work during this, and this is a shot of the Natural History Museum from the front. It's a rather large building, and it, you know, you can't see it all at once. This is the best shot, and it's during when the leaves are on the trees. And how do I get back to the other? I must have. I mean, this. I assume. Okay, yeah, thanks very much. And by the way, here's a couple more present-day street scenes from South Kensington. There's lots of shops, as you may imagine, and people milling about and so forth, and lots of music venues. Here's the museum. This is not what we're supposed to. Here's a shot of the interior of the museum at night, the main hall. Here's another shot that probably Brian will like. This is the whale at the Natural History Museum. And Donovan actually wrote a song about the whale at the Natural History Museum. It's called Museum. which was a minor hit for the group, some of you may remember or heard of, Herman's Hermits. Meet me under the whale at the Natural History Museum. Here's the back of the museum, which has a new addition on it, all is glassed in, as you can see, for the Darwin celebrations of a couple of years back. Now, if you look really carefully, you can see the outline of a huge building inside. See the white kind of... And if you are inside the glass, this is what it looks like. This is the side of the what they call the cocoon, which is six stories tall. It's a big Darwin research and exhibit display, you know, // thing that they built for this. But actually, if you get up near the top, and you can actually look down on it from some of the new structures up above, it looks very much like a really fat 747 jet, is what it looks like from the top. That was my immediate impression. Here's me with my colleague George Baccaloni doing a little promo shot for the book a couple of years back.
Is he the bug guy?
Yeah, he's the bug guy. He and his, he's an insect curator at the Natural History Museum. And his wife is a spiders curator. So. Now, I also got down again to the Linnaean Society, which is in Burlington House, which is a big complex. And the general entranceway to Burlington House, which has a big courtyard and everything in back, is right here. And on the entrance is the oldest operating telephone booth in England. And there it is, right there, right in that entranceway. And if you go through the entranceway and into the courtyard, this is what it looks like. This statue is, I think, is temporary. They're having some big art thing, but the Royal Institute of Art, the Royal Society of Chemistry, and a couple of other royals. And the Linnaean Society is in this corner. This is the library reading room of the Linnaean Society, a fairly famous room. And if you look up, went the wrong way. This is what looking up toward the second floor looks like. And all the books are, you know, stacked up there, and they look, you know, very elegant, stacked all the way around.
So did you have to climb some ladders to get to your materials?
No, I didn't. I have many pictures of the Natural History Museum Library, which is nothing special to look at, although it's the largest natural history library in the world. It has about the same number of volumes that we have. But just on natural history subjects. It's bigger than the Smithsonian, it's bigger than the American Museum, but it's kind of wedged into all the corners and so forth, and it isn't sort of out there like the Linnaean Society. And there's the plaque at the Linnaean Society, of Alfie's plaque, I call it.
Co-discoverer.
And we're getting close to the end here. I also spent some time at the British Library. Now, this is a new British Library. It looks like a big ship that's driven into the middle of the St. Pancras area. And in back is the ancient St. Pancras station. I've got several shots of it from different angles. Here's another one from more of the street level, from the courtyard in front of it. This is from the street on the other side. This is looking into the main entranceway across the courtyard. The next one is from inside. If you walk in the building and look up, it's all this huge open area with the different mezzanine levels, which have all the different new reading rooms. If you turn around and look back out, that's what it looks like. A huge entrance area that has exhibit halls and information and, you know, a library shop where you buy stuff. And also right in the middle is this huge structure which is completely glassed in of ancient, they're all leather-bound books. And it's just like it's there deliberately for display. Just, you know, up 100 feet or so and 100 feet wide. Of glassed-in old books. Now, one of the last things I did was to go out to one of the surrounding cities of Hartford, spelled H-E-R-T-F-O-R-D. It's about 40 minutes, 30 minutes from England. It's about the size of Bowling Green, but it looks much different on the street, as you can see. And the day I was there was Saturday, and this was all filled in with vendors. I mean, there was no traffic or anything, so it had sort of like a medieval fair type of atmosphere to it. Here's another shot in Hartford, just to generally give you an idea of what the town looks like downtown, so to speak. And this, lastly, is the Wallace was born in Wales, but he moved at a very young age to Hartford. And this was the first house that the Wallace family lived in Hartford. In fact, there's a little plaque that says, you know, Wallace slept here. thing here. And that's it. That's the end. After that, I was going to take one more day to do a quiet sightseeing tour from a bus, and that was the one day out of 5 weeks that I didn't feel so good, so I let that go and then zipped off back home. I should mention, after spending a lot of time, especially in the Natural History Museum, and finding all sorts of good manuscript materials and even some other printed materials that they have in their rather large collection of Wallace materials. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
You were inducted into the Linnaean Society a few years ago. Does that get you special privileges when you go in that building? Do you get to...
Well, they don't keep me out.
They don't keep you out.
It's semi-public, meaning there's nothing stopping you from going in there, but they do have a security person at the door who makes you sign in.
But you don't get a special chair to sit in or anything?
Well, I mean, they knew where I was coming in this case, so I don't know, you know, if you were just a tourist and you walked in, what they would say, but you know, I didn't feel like they were pressuring me adding in. I don't know if the guard certainly didn't know that I was a member, and the people I was meeting with did, but, you know, they may have said, be on the lookout for a bedraggled American or something.
Were the people friendly and pleasant?
Yeah, on the whole, they were quite nice. Yeah, the Brits have this kind of... I don't want to say gruff exactly, but they're not as reserved as they come across, you know, in some venues. And you know, they were, whenever I needed help or anything, they were happy to help me out. So I certainly have no complaints. I'm trying to think of any unfriendliness. No, I didn't get any unfriendliness. I had a grand time one of the few times I took taxis and good conversations with the cab drivers. That was fun.
Could you tell they were preparing for the Olympics?
Yes.
Signs everywhere?
Yes. There were scaffolding everywhere, and especially in that area, because that's South Kensington is like one of the two or three most important places in London in terms of visibility. There's all those museums. There's the Science Museum, the Science and Technology Museum, the Natural History Museum, you know, again, Royal Albert Hall and a bunch of embassies and, you know, just all sorts of structures. In fact, you walk down the street, and there are lots of tourists, obviously, too, and dozens of hotels in the general area. You walk down the street and you would hear foreign languages, that is non-English, spoken more than would English. You know, more people were speaking non-English than English as you walked along. So they were cleaning it up. They wanted to, you know, the people that were going to come to visit for, you know, for the Olympics and everything, they wanted to look as nice as they could.
In Brazil, were the universities open, kind of like this one, where anyone can walk on campus, or were they more secure, guarded?
I get the feeling that they're a little more secure, although the University of Sao Paulo is so big, it covers 2 square miles. It's a very physically big university as well as being a very good university. So I don't know what their security is like, but the Unicinos University had a gate that you went through as if it were a military institution, basically. You know, you would stop at the gate and and then go in. And then after that, I mean, I didn't see like armed guards or anything like that, but it seemed fairly open.
Did you have specific materials in mind at each of these institutions?
Yes, I did. Yeah, there's a 300-page finding aid of the Walls collection at the Natural History Museum, and they have it up, and it has some errors in it that I found, and that was one of the reasons why they were happy to have me there, to correct errors in their finding aid. They had purchased several years earlier for about $250,000 a huge amount of Wallace personal materials from the Wallace family. As it turns out, Wallace's two grandchildren are still alive.
Wow.
Which is amazing considering the fact that he was born in 1823. I mean, it was a donation, but it was also a $250,000 windfall, and I guess they figured giving it to the Natural History Museum was a natural thing to do rather than worrying about it, you know, how they're going to dispose of it after they died. It seems reasonable. It's now the largest individual collection at the library, and I understand they're thinking of renaming the library the Alfred Russel Wallace Library. Brian?
Well, could you talk a little about in your first trip to England when you actually met one of the grandchildren?
Yeah, I have a couple of slides of him. I don't have them here. He was really nice. He didn't look all that much like Alfred Russel Wallace, and he was not. Wallace was, I think, 6 feet one or something when he was younger, which in those days was very tall, and the grandson that I met was maybe 5'8", I'm guessing, but you could still recognize that it was Wallace. He had that shot that I had up of Wallace initially. He had exactly the same hair.
Wow.
Combed the same way with the same thickness and, you know, and color and everything. it just sort of shouted out at me immediately when I met him. I did not meet the other grandson. Anything further?
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. We have one little bit of business. We have three door prizes today, and it looks like your chances are pretty good at this point.
All right. So you'll pull one of the